ask a question before we start?
Yes.
So where did that came from? The first menagerie relation there came from the exponential thing, or we just took the menagerie part. What about the real part? Does that give us more conditions?
That's something you see this afternoon in the tutorial. The spoiler is, it's nothing new, but it reproduces another class of old relations in field theory when you send alpha prime to zero. And okay, it's also an interesting linear combination of these imaginary part relations, which at first glance doesn't look like such a linear combination. But if all you want to do is get to a basis of n minus 3 factorial, it's sufficient if you work with these imaginary parts.
But even in the case of W, since it's symmetric in the two permutations, you have less elements.
It's true. It's not fully fair to speak of n minus 3 factorial times n minus 3 factorial. If we are honest, we would need to, it's not exactly a half, but we need to cut it down. Mod out by the symmetry flips. Yeah, that's a good point. I agree. Okay, any other questions before we start? Then let me give a brief reminder of some of yesterday's highlights. I wrapped up the chapter on open string trees by giving you the final bunch of relations that govern disk integrals. Namely, these were the monotremy relations when you fiddle around with the integration domain other than the integrand. I mean, we have seen way before that there are BCJ relations in the integrands, in the Park-Taylors, very simple ones, where the coefficients are homogeneous in alpha prime. And then yesterday we went through the slightly more sophisticated monotremy relations, where different choices of the integration contour are related by complex phases, or after taking the imaginary part, by trigonometry. Good, so this finished off the open string part, then we proceeded to closed strings. Among other things, you saw the following amplitude formula for the endpoint function of the type 2a, type 2b superstrings, where I already took the liberty to plug in our knowledge of the open string correlator, which appears there with a square. So here, that's once more this double copy form of the open string correlator. And let's say, since we assume we already know what these field theory packages are, the only leftover challenge is to get control over the integrals. So this is basically the juice of what is left to be done in order to fully slice down this closed superstring amplitude. So I introduced this notation for the most general sphere integral in there, where we assume that everything is in Park-Taylor form. So there's one Park-Taylor for the meromorphic part. So this is carrying the SL2 weight of one open string half of your closed string vertex operators. And then there is an independent Park-Taylor for the Z-bars, the anti-meromorphic part coming from the second chiral half of the closed string vertex operator. And of course, there is no need for the two orderings to be correlated, since we take the modulus square of this big permutation sum. Okay, we also looked at the BCJ relation satisfied by this one. So the relations satisfied by this guy are even simpler than what we have seen in case of the disk integrals. But nevertheless, knowing the relations doesn't free us from computing a basis of these integrals. And in order to do that, we use the KLT relations. So I just presented the four-point case in the form of a claim yesterday. So if beta and rho are four-point permutations, then yesterday's claim was that you can factorize this sphere integral into a product of disk integrals. One disk integral in the 1, 2, 3, 4 ordering, and another one in a slightly different ordering. And amusingly, the coefficient here is the same kind of trigonometric factor that we are used to from the open string monotomy relations. That's already a smoking gun that monotomy relations for the open string are closely related to KLT relations to disentangle the closed string integrals. And indeed, if we go through the proof of this, we will see that the same kind of monotomy tricks appear, the same kind of complex phases, when you trade z to the s for modulus z to the s. And even though I was full of good intentions to show you the proof right here, I think out of timing reasons, we have to relegate this to the homework sheet. So this is going to be some reading homework. I mean, the proof is beautifully there in the 86 paper. With more time, I would be very happy to do it live. But maybe there are other things we want to cover. Yeah, sorry for not doing this on the spot. Okay, then the next thing to be said about KLT. Well, this is just a statement on the integrals. Of course, the primary application is to plug it into the amplitude. Obviously, if you expand the four-point amplitude like this and do the gymnastics with the KLT decomposition of W, you inevitably land on this formula here. Closed string 4 points being given as follows in terms of a square of open string amplitudes. And as the first new thing for today's lecture, let me ask, does this look permutation symmetric to you? We are scattering closed strings, so all of these external states enter as punctures on a sphere. There's no notion of ordering on the sphere. We want to have a permutation symmetric amplitude, but staring at the right-hand side, this is probably not manifest, at least not to me. So in order to see that it is secretly permutation symmetric, say, if you want to check that if you exchange labels 2 and 4, you still get the same amplitude, you need to supplement some info on the disk integrals. Does anyone have a suspicion? What's the reason that it works? What's the reason that this expression is symmetric under exchange in 2 and 4? For sure, the sign factor will change. And when sign factors are floating around, that smells like monotomy relations. So the consistency condition of the KLT formula here is set by the monotomy relation. And OK, it's up to us whether we want to write it in terms of A open or in terms of the z integral. OK, since the z integral version is already up there, I write it in terms of open string amplitudes for your entertainment. So the reason why this formula is symmetric under exchange in 2 and 4 is the following one, that I can take this A open with a bar. OK, it doesn't really rely on the bar, but the point is that we urgently need this as a consistency condition. I'm even tempted to say KLT was invented in 86, and in principle, the community should have learned about monotomy relations already back then in the 80s, simply by playing with the permutation properties. You were about to ask a question? OK. So yeah, this is the four-point incarnation of KLT. And of course, we are all burning to see that at endpoints. And in order to do this compactly, let me introduce a rewriting of a four-point using an alpha prime dependent kernel. It's a alpha prime deformation of this S0 kernel, which we have seen a lot of times. So the idea is to replace all the Sij in the old kernel by the corresponding trigonometric function, and to tailor the normalization such that for alpha prime to zero, we land on the old kernel. So to make sure that there's no normalization headache, I'm inserting these factors for convenience. OK, and then we are ready to write down a recursion to infer the 5-point, 6-point, n-point version of that kernel. It's almost identical to the recursion you have seen before, or in yesterday's tutorial. The only minor difference is that we put all the momenta into a sine function. OK, so this funny notation with the multiparticle labels, I hope you digested it yesterday in the tutorial. OK, so that's the recursion for an endpoint version of this string theory KLT kernel. OK, so having this definition in front of us, it's a very compact business to write down the endpoint version of the KLT relations. So let me write it at the level of the sphere integrals. I mean, here in the four-point case, we had the luxury that there was only one term. But we already know from field theory KLT, 4 points is very degenerate. That this n minus 3 factorial basis of various things degenerates down to one element. So accordingly, if we go beyond 4 points, there's a bit of combinatorial gymnastics that we have to sum over different permutations of our integration contours. OK, there are a lot of Greek letters, a lot of permutations. It's quite easy to get lost, so let me specify with colors which are the dynamical permutations and which ones are the spectators. So let's remember that we are talking about a sphere integral with given Park Taylors in the integrand. These are the beta and the rho. And all of these Park Taylors are completely unimpressed by what we do to the contour. So beta and rho are just Park Taylors. They are just spectators. So the real magic happens here for the integration contours, where we are moving around within these n minus 3 factorial bases with respect to the monotomy relations. And all of this follows from contour tricks similar to the one at 4 points. And one paper where this is presented in a very detailed and quite pedagogical way is ...2010. It's not the first time that endpoint KLT was done, but it's presented in a really recommendable manner. OK. So just as a nice check for you, let me suggest you to go through this formula and investigate it in the alpha prime to zero limit. So please check consistency with, so the desired alpha prime to zero limit. I told you yesterday that also these W integrals degenerate to the doubly partial amplitude if you send alpha prime to zero limit. Please check that this is the case in that formula. Using, this is a little hint, using the alpha prime to zero behavior of the S alpha kernel. Okay, let me stress that this KLT formula allows you to process a sphere integral no matter where you come across it. Maybe it's not a type 2 superstring that you do, but maybe you're a practitioner of heterotic strings. Also, this one is full of sphere integrals, and you can just plug in that relation for the heterotic string. So this is the, say, maximally flexible way of formulating that thing. But if all you want is a closed string amplitude of type 2b, then, of course, we can look at the specialized version of it. And this is probably the more traditional way of telling the story, that if you want a closed string amplitude, then you just do the same combinatorics of integration contours as down there, that you do some A open, and put it to the alpha prime dependent KLT kernel along with a second A open. Here we go. And since I just dwelled on universality, well, this does not straightforwardly apply to heterotic strings, but it doesn't require a detailed knowledge of the A open. We don't even need to know here that A open boils down to Young-Mills trees. So here you can use any representation of the respective open string amplitudes. And strictly speaking, it's universal to both superstring and bosonic strings. And the story about the permutation symmetry that I spelled out in detail at 4 points, of course, the same game can be played here, that this KLT formula for closed string amplitudes, it's permutation invariant. By monotomy relations of the respective open string amplitudes. Any further question on this? So this was the KLT story for the old school superstring before people started to play with ambitwister strings and before the twisted strings came back to the surface of interest. So let me now remind you of something that Piotr told you. There is a quantization ambiguity when you play with superstrings. You can change your notion of creation and annihilation operators on one of the sides, the holomorphic or the anti-holomorphic side. So the other choice you could have made is referred to as twisted strings. And let's look at what's the counterpart of KLT relations for these twisted strings. So let me write it out, what I just said. In Piotr's lecture, you were encouraged to flip the role of creation and annihilation operators on one of the two chiral halves. Let's say in the holomorphic sector, you leave everything as it is, while in the anti-holomorphic sector, you do this flip of creation and annihilation operators. This is the definition of twisted strings. And what I want to investigate with you now is, how does this choice you can make, how does it affect the amplitudes, this role flip of creation and annihilation operators? What are, which parts of the calculation for the conventional superstring, which parts can I recycle in case of twisted strings, and where do I need to make some tweaks? What are the fingerprints of that twist? So one way to get started on that is to remember the two-point function. The driving force in all of these CFT calculations was in the two-point function of the boson. And in the untwisted case, we had log of z minus w square, modulus square. So if you want to, you can pull this modulus square apart and write it as a sum of that log of the unbarred variables plus the log of the barred variables. But if you do twisted strings, if you change the role of creators and annihilators here, you generate a relative minus sign. So this is our first step in tracking the implications of the twist. So here I'm spelling out the two-point function of the twisted string that is proportional to the difference of log meromorphic minus log antimeromorphic. And for sure, the Kober-Nielsen factor is crucially affected by that. I mean, the derivation of the Kober-Nielsen factor amounts to exponentiating this two-point function. So what's the new version of it? So traditionally, I would give the z's and the z bars the same exponent in the untwisted Kober-Nielsen factor. But now there are some signs floating around. It means that you have different exponents, plus Sij and minus Sij, on the two sides. So maybe I should use some color to highlight the differences. That's the first implication of the twist, and that's the second implication of the twist. Now, if we start an amplitude calculation in that twisted framework, for sure we will face sphere integrals including that twisted Kober-Nielsen factor. And we didn't talk much about that. These sphere integrals, well, they amount to integrating punctures all over the complex plane. And there are singularities at infinity, at zero, at one. I mean, it's very delicate to check the domain of convergence of these integrals. And a lot of times I was secretly doing analytic continuation. And all of these convergence issues become way more severe if you do that twist here. This has crucial impact on the convergence or non-convergence of these sphere integrals. So orders of magnitude of extra care is required. And strictly speaking, the analytic continuations you need to do, they require different kinematic regions on the left and right movers. All this to say, if you just proceed to doing that twist in your integrands over there, you get nonsense. These integrals become ill-defined. So instead, we need to define a regularized version or a properly analytically continued version of these twisted string integrals. That's why you see the word define here. Let's define what we mean by integrals over that twisted Kober-Nielsen factors. We want to integrate this twisted Kober-Nielsen factor over the sphere, which is very, very delicate. But let's just define a regularized version via KLT. So a definition which I dare to consider as natural is just flip the sign of alpha prime on one of the two sides. Or, well, instead of saying sides, in one of the Z's. I guess this definition is not too unnatural. We have seen in the opening line what the twist does is reversing the sign of all the anti-meromorphic contributions. And strictly speaking, this two-point function has an alpha prime in it, just by dimensional analysis. So one way to think about this minus sign is that you have used minus alpha prime when you referred to the right mover. So let's just export this notion to the KOT formula. We have some z integrals for the left movers, other z integrals for the right movers. Let's just flip the sign of alpha prime in all the right movers we see. So let me spell that out in full glory. Let's define a twisted version of the sphere integral in the following manner. Okay, let me start with some quotation marks. If that integral was well defined, I would be talking about the following expression here. So this is the ill-defined expression that we are about to fill with meaning. And the way we regularize that, or the way how we give a meaning to it, is we just say, repeat the KLT exercise from the untwisted case and sprinkle minus signs to alpha prime. So let's keep everything from the KLT formula, including the kernel. By the way, the kernel is symmetric under reversal of alpha prime. So it's up to you whether or not you put minus alpha prime here. Okay, and this is now where the twist happens. Let's pretend that this is the z-bar part from the KLT formula, or from the derivation of the KLT formula. And this is where we flip alpha prime to minus alpha prime. Okay, now for the disk integrals, we have an expression in our pocket, and expression which doesn't suffer too much if we flip the sign of alpha prime. So this is a good definition for the W twist. And now let me come to the shocker. We looked at the alpha prime dependence of the four-point sphere integrals. You saw some gamma functions that looked very similar to the gamma functions you saw for the open superstring. And of course, we can do this gamma function game at four points once more. And if you do this carefully, then you will find that this no longer depends on alpha prime. This is the time you should get a heart attack. Alpha prime drops out from here by this innocent operation of flipping the sign on one of the two sides. So let me give you an exact formula for that guy here. I mean, in the untwisted case, I was telling you that the limit alpha prime goes to zero gives you doubly partial amplitudes. But now, there is no limit alpha prime to zero on the left-hand side. This is an exact result. Isn't this weird? the first time I've seen this as an observation was in that paper. It's a 5. Involving Ellis, one of the former PSI students, Warren Siegel and Yu-Tin Huang. And later on, Sebastian explained why this has to happen, why this is not a big surprise. Sebastian gave a beautiful explanation using intersection theory. Paper from last year, November, which I encourage all of you to read. Okay, and to make sure you have a fair chance to see this happening in front of you, I suggest you to check that explicitly for a 4-point case. I guess I asked you for some checks on the untwisted friend of this integral. When you did KLT on the untwisted version of that, just go back to that calculation and see how the flip of alpha prime on one of the sides, how it goes through the arguments you used. On the risk of saying something redundant, this reflection identity for the sine function was your Swiss Army knife in this exercise. And this doesn't change if you flip alpha prime on one of the two sides. Okay, so this was again a series of rather technical remarks on these sphere integrals. Let me try to get back to the big picture, in particular to Piotr's lecture. Piotr was telling you that ambi-twister strings can't be directly reached from the conventional superstrings in the way we traditionally quantize it, but you have better chances if you use this twisted string instead. And Piotr was telling you that you need to send alpha prime to infinity in the twisted string. To reach the ambi-twister string. And Piotr was furthermore pointing out
that, zero or infinity.
Oops, thank you so much. It's infinity. Thanks, Freddy. And Piotr was furthermore pointing out that there are two flavors of these twisted strings, the bosonic string version and the superstring version. Okay, to be precise, there's the type 2a, type 2b. So how much work is it to do these limits? Well, in the superstring flavor, that limit is trivial, at least after you have inserted that you can expand your closed string amplitudes in this manner. So if you look at the superstring incarnation of the twisted strings, to study twisted superstrings, then there is no alpha prime dependence at all. Let me emphasize, this is really a luxury that, first of all, this formula allows to expand that guy in terms of W integrals. And the coefficients are just field theory packages, A. Young-Mills, who don't depend on alpha prime. So there's no alpha prime coming from the kinematics. And as far as the integral concerns are concerned, there's also no alpha prime dependence from the integrals after using the intersection theory wisdom. There's no alpha prime dependence at all in the twisted superstring amplitude. And therefore, the limit is trivial. If it doesn't depend on alpha prime, it doesn't bother you where you send alpha prime to. This time, I would even get away with the typo. However, there's also the bosonic model of twisted strings, and there the limit is no longer trivial. So to give you an overview, if you take the bosonic twisted string, of course, it's still true that you don't get alpha prime from the sphere integrals. But I haven't told you what the analog of that formula is for bosonic strings. And the coefficients of the sphere integrals will depend on alpha prime. These are some kinematic factors that even include tachyon poles, and for sure they depend on alpha prime. So let me just warn you that the coefficients of these twisted W integrals do depend on alpha prime. And then there's a non-trivial limit. But yes, it's quite interesting. The limit or the result of the bosonic ambitwister string was proposed in the literature before, and we later on find a finite alpha prime version of that, which describes bosonic string amplitudes. And we could verify that these kinematic factors in the bosonic string case, that they're really reduced to what we want in case of the bosonic ambitwister strings. Please approach me if you want to have more information on that. But yeah, so this brings me to the end point of the closed string discussion. You have seen two flavors of KLT, the traditional one with plus alpha prime on both sides, and now the new chiral one, where you flip alpha prime on one of the sides and where all of a sudden things are on the nose, doubly partial amplitudes in Y-joint scalars. Any further questions on that? Okay, let's now come to the math part. Let's now discuss alpha prime expansions. And the interesting intersection of string theory and number theory. I told you at the beginning that you can do two kinds of expansions to these Schwarzschild integrals, either pole expansion, where you study the massive states that are exchanged, or you do alpha prime to zero expansion. You do a Taylor expansion or Laurent expansion with respect to alpha prime. And in that picture, you pretend that all the massive states were integrated out. And it's the latter that we will follow now. So this will zoom onto the alpha prime expansion, this effective field theory analysis, where the massive states are mentally integrated out. And you already saw some examples for the subleading orders in alpha prime beyond field theory. You saw some first instances of zeta values popping up. And I will now describe the more general class of these multiple zeta values and embed them into a framework of polylogarithms tomorrow. And these are pretty universal tools. Of course, they appear prominently in these string calculations, but if you want to do perturbative QCD and evaluate Feynman integrals, you find the same system of functions. And I dare to say, string theory might be a good starting drug to get into this business, since you see all of them in a very pure form in string theory. Okay, so to give a definition of multiple zeta values, well, the idea is to generalize the Riemann zeta that you have seen before. To multiple arguments. So let's feed it with arguments, n1, n2, and as many as you wish. Here, r is the number of the arguments. And the definition of Riemann zeta was an infinite sum. You sum over all integers k, and you raise them to some negative power. And it's the argument who decides which negative power it is. And let's now do the following generalization. Let's do a nested sum. Let's independently sum k2, k3 over the integers, but maybe not fully independent. Let's impose inequalities. So multiple zeta values are defined as nested sums, where the summand is the straightforward generalization, but where on top of that you have some inequalities. Okay, and before anyone gets worried about the convergence, similar to the Riemann zeta values, we have to make sure that the last element is 2 or larger. Okay, if I don't specify that these are integers, this might be a little bit too strict, but in everything you see in this lecture, these nj's will be positive integers. So this gives you a multiple zeta value. And let me bother you with a little bit of more terminology. There are two major quantum numbers one assigns to such an object. First of all, the number of arguments has a nickname. This is the depth. And another nickname is there for the sum of all the arguments. This is referred to as the transcendental weight. Complicated word. It's admittedly an abusive terminology. I will tell you later on why. But let's just take this as a nickname for the moment. Okay, so with this definition, let me tell you why string amplitudes care about these guys, namely the alpha prime expansion. Of all the disk and sphere integrals you might see, any multiplicity, are full of them. Let me give an impression. Schematic impression. Okay, in terms of mass dimension, the leading order of all of these disk integrals you saw, the leading orders were doubly partial amplitudes. And the normalization was chosen in such a way that there's no alpha prime in the leading order. So just in terms of mass dimension, I can factor out something with many negative powers and momenta. And then the alpha prime corrections insert more derivatives, but always in the dimensionless combination. And the first alpha prime correction is always at sub-leading order. Nothing linear in S, but the smallest correction has four additional derivatives. You saw a four-point example of that. And just to remind you, the alpha primes are hidden inside this Sij. So this term is alpha prime square. And now if you ask about the higher order terms, let me be even more schematic. You get a series in these Sij, and therefore a series in alpha prime. And the coefficients are going to be multiple zeta values of transcendental weight n. So this is a very strong constraint or a very bold claim. Here I'm saying that there is a correlation between the order of alpha prime and the transcendental weight of all the multiple zeta values. So let me make this claim a little bit more precise. You get an infinite series in Sij whose coefficients are multiple zeta values, more precisely rational number linear combinations. I mean, pi square is a multiple zeta value itself. That's why this disclaimer here is necessary. And already this requires a lot of math work to show that the coefficients are multiple zeta values of whatsoever weight. So the math heroes who went through this for the first time are Tomohide Terasoma in 2002 and Francis Brown in 2006. At that time, they were not caring about string theory, but they did care about the moduli space of punctured disks and spheres. So they were exploring what are the periods of that moduli space. What can you get by integrating within the moduli space of these punctured world sheets? Though they didn't say world sheet. Anyway, they found that you get linear combinations of multiple zeta values. And this second statement about the correlation, let me highlight this a bit more. The order of alpha prime in the expansion of these z integrals. And by the way, I can interchangeably write w here. The same, almost the same statements go through if you do w instead. The order of alpha prime is 1-to-1 correlated to the transcendental weight of the accompanying multiple zeta values. And this property even has a name. This is the next time where this tongue twister appears. Uniform transcendentality. This buzzword here is a fancy way of saying if you check at the wth order of alpha prime, then the transcendental weight is w for all the multiple zeta values along with that order. Okay, now I talked about transcendentality for a sufficient number of times. Now it's really time to give you the disclaimer why this is nonsense.
Could you also have products of two zeta values that have lower transcendentality?
Oh, good point. Oh, good point, good point. So I should have said already here that a transcendental weight is understood to add up in products. Very good point. So it's a definition. Transcendental weight adds up in products. So in other words, zeta m times zeta n as weight, m plus n, or is said to have weight m plus n. Okay, now the disclaimer is the following. When you hear that definition of transcendental weight, it probably raises your expectation that we are talking about transcendental numbers. And for some of the zetas, this is true. For all the even single zetas, it is known that they are a rational multiple of pi to the power 2k. And you will look at that in detail in the tutorial today. So this is obviously transcendental, simply because pi is transcendental. Oh, and just to be on the safe side, the definition of a transcendental number is that you can't get it as a zero of a polynomial with integer coefficients, just to remind you. So being transcendental is even more hardcore than being irrational. Okay, so here for the even zeta values, everything is safe, but the status in the odd zeta sector, zeta 3 and all of these guys, it's quite embarrassing. None of them were proven to be transcendental. We only know that zeta 3 is irrational. Well, that's a weaker form of transcendental. And we know that there is an infinite number of irrational odd zeta values. If you go through zeta 5, 7, 9, et cetera, there's an infinite number of irrational instances. But this doesn't tell you anything about their transcendentality. So it's commonly believed that they're all going to be transcendental. There is no contrary evidence. But it's just a conjecture. And this terminology, transcendental weight, is based on trusting that conjecture. A more systematic way of trusting these conjectures is the notion of motives, but I'm afraid I won't be able to cover this. Okay, this was a very large amount of abstract information. Let me get to a down-to-earth four-point example that you will derive in the tutorial. So far, I think I only gave you the leading or the subleading orders of disk and sphere integrals. Let me now spell out the all-order result, which at the four-point level can be written down with minimal effort. So for the four-point sphere and disk integrals, okay, I'm choosing an example where the field theory limit is super slim. You can get the entire expansion in terms of zeta values from this closed form with an exponential. So here in the open string, we have an exponential involving all the single zeta values. Like that. And good news, here we can see uniform transcendentality happen in front of us. How many powers of alpha prime do we have here? These are n powers, and the coefficient is zeta n, weight n. It fits for each term of the exponential, and if you multiply out, if you expand the exponential as a series in its argument, it's not altered. Perfect. Uniform transcendentality confirmed. And now let me write the analogous closed string result. At first glance, it looks same. But to be precise, it's only a subset of the zeta values which appears here. Oops. So a striking observation here is that only the odd zeta values appear. Amusingly, it's those zeta values where we know less about them, at least as far as their transcendentality is concerned. Somehow the closed string doesn't like pi. Because the even zetas were rational multiples of pi. I will put this into a more general context tomorrow. I will tell you a more general framework what it means to set pi to zero. And you will hear about the general selection rules, which zeta values can appear in a closed string amplitude. And how are they related to the zeta values in the open string ones? So this is just an appetizer. Now, looking at this four-point result, you might roll your eyes and ask, why the hell did I give you this multiple zeta value with multiple arguments, if 4 points only requires the Riemann zeta with a single argument? So without offering a closed formula like that, let me just give some general information about higher points. You do get higher depth zeta values at 5 points and beyond. And I will shortly give you a table. What is the first irreducible higher depth zeta value that you can't express in terms of these guys? This will come in a few minutes, but let me already do the name dropping. Namely, you can't help having a double zeta, for instance, this one, in typical 5-point Z integrals. And by uniform transcendentality, this shows up at the order alpha prime to the eighth. So alpha prime to the eighth is the first time where you see, damn it, Riemann zeta values are insufficient to express all the coefficients of the SIJs. So for the open string, that happens at alpha prime to the eighth for the first time. And the sphere integrals, you saw it from there, they appear to be more picky, which zeta values they accept. And indeed, if you want to see a multi-argument zeta value in a closed string, you have to go to pretty high order. It's the 11th order of alpha prime, where you see a higher depth zeta value for the first time, or where you can't avoid higher depth for the first time. So this is just a preview to make you confident that it is rewarding to go through these definitions.
And you have even arguments in the closed string, when you have zeta 2.7.4.
No irreducibles. Whenever
they are not irreducible.
You can always write them as products of odd zeta values. You do get the square of this guy at weight 22.
Yeah,
but not an even irreducible. Carlos?
If we were to write an effective Lagrangian, would it have a lot of zeta values?
Oh yeah, I mean, if you were to write the four-point effective Lagrangian, it would be a series in all of these zeta values and products thereof. And if you want to have an effective action that is also exact at the five-point order, sooner or later, these guys would be there in the effective action. Okay, so next I want to try to give you some more intuition why these zeta values are related to string amplitudes. At first glance, this might look a bit ad hoc. There's these funny nested sums, but in fact, we're doing integrals. These z's and w's are iterated integrals. So how does this fit together? So let me try to bring the world of nested sums and the world of iterated integrals a little bit closer together. Why are mzvs the appropriate quantities in the z's and w's? And in particular, I want to give intuition for the story with the z's. You can always go to an SL2 frame where all the integration happens in the unit interval. If you SL2 fix z1 to 0, if you SL2 fix zn minus 1 to be 1, and furthermore zn to infinity, it's a frame we have used dozens of times, then the canonically ordered z's are iterated integrals over the unit interval. And let me now connect multiple zeta values with iterated integrals over precisely that range. One can map mzvs to iterated integrals. And for fans of computer science, this will now be a moment to introduce a binary code. We need a two-letter alphabet of differential forms to do that mapping. This is d log z and something like d log 1 minus z. We will look at iterated integrals composed from this two-letter alphabet of differential forms. So having this alphabet, we can define an integral zeta as follows. Let's just integrate many of them over such a simplex, over an integration region with all of these inequalities. So let's take one of these forms at z1, another form at z2, and you go on and on and on with as many forms as you like. And for each of the forms, there's a choice whether you like d log z more or whether you like d log 1 minus z more. So let's leave a freedom to choose here and here and there. Okay, so for each sequence of zeros and ones, there is one iterated integral that, for suggestive reason, I also called zeta. I hope that there's no confusion. If subscripts are following, then zeta refers to a nested sum. If brackets are following, then zeta refers to an iterated integral. And the dictionary will be given more or less now. Okay, so the first remark about this iterated integral. Convergence is all right if the first entry is 1 and if the last entry is 0. Otherwise, you get a divergence of the flavor log 0. Don't try to evaluate log 0. And the key feature is that you can recover the nested sum zetas. And it's Koncevich who found that. If you want to roll back to the nested sum representation of zeta values, then what you need to do is you need to find a suitable sequence of zeros and ones to build up these integer arguments. And the code is the following. In order to get the first argument under control, n1, you start with a letter 1, and then you adjoin n1 minus 1 successive zeros. But now we are just done with the first argument. What do we do for n2? We do the same. For n2, we start with a 1 and then adjoin a couple of zeros, namely n2 minus 1 of them. And you repeat this for each of these integer arguments until you are left with that one. And one exercise in the tutorial is to check that for a simple case. Now, a little side remark. For the nested sums, we wanted to that nr is 2 or larger. This was a convergence issue. And this maps to the other convergence issue here. This ends with 0 if nr is 2 or larger. Otherwise, we would have no appended zero. Okay, so convergent nested sums are mapped to convergent iterated integrals, just as a consistency check. And let's see how our notions of depth and weight look like in this iterated integral language. So the depth R, the number of arguments, this translates into how many letters 1 do you insert? So the depth translates into the number of omega 1s in that iterated integral. And the weight, transcendental weight, which is the sum of all arguments, is just translating into how many integrations do we perform. This is also something you could take as a definition of weight. Maybe you find some mathematicians out there, if you ask them what's the transcendental weight, they might reply that's the minimum number of integrations you need to perform to build up that object. Okay, so I hope that this dictionary between iterated integrals and nested sums gives you a first flavor, gives you a positive feeling why we can confidently expect multiple zeta values when we deal with these disk integrals, simply because the flavor of integration domain matches. It smells like we are on a good track. But now I think we need to fill a couple of gaps. I was telling you confidently that there's no multiple zeta value here, and you can't avoid a multiple zeta value there when you're at 5 points. What is the criterion whether or not you can avoid these? We need a way to talk about relations among multiple zeta values. And I want to show you two mechanisms to generate a huge number of relations over the rational numbers. This is about relations among MZVs over Q, where the coefficients are rational. And the key idea is, well, we have seen two different representations of multiple zeta values, nested sums and iterated integrals. And to get the maximum number of relations, why not use the combined power of these two representations? So that's what we'll try to do. As a warm-up, let me point out the so-called duality property. That's a relation which is transparent via integrals. So here we have tons of integration variables z, which are between 0 and 1. And what about the variable transformation y goes is 1 minus z? That will keep you in the unit interval. So why not do this variable transformation everywhere? And as a result, you get the duality relation. You can do two things at the same time. You reverse the ordering of these little a's, but at the same time, you exchange zeros and ones. So the first relation you generate in this way is zeta 1, 2 equal zeta 3. And to check that duality relation in detail, let me suggest you to work out that omega A of Z is minus omega 1 minus A of Y. Just to derive that relation carefully. But okay, this is just the warm-up duality. Let me come to the more interesting classes of relations. Let me go on with what is called shuffle. The idea behind shuffle is that you do rearrangements of schematic form, well, we're looking at iterated integrals where you have inequalities. So typical integration domains look like that. And they describe a triangle in a two-dimensional plane spanned by z1 and z2. And maybe you want to add another triangle with the opposite order of z1 and z2. So we are having these two triangles here. And what happens if you put them together? That's just a triangulation of the square, independently integrating z1 and z2. And this very down-to-earth exercise has a beautiful generalization, which is known as the shuffle relation. So I'm writing down a slight generalization of that triangulation of the square now, and explain the symbols in a minute. So shuffle works with ordered sets. Here, this capital A is a collective notation for many letters little a. Many letters little a as you see it over there. So this is just a placeholder for one of these integrals over there. And of course, the same with capital B, which represents a sequence of letters little b. Okay, now what is the right-hand side? What is A shuffle B? I think the most helpful explanation is, how can you shuffle cards? Imagine A is a deck of cards. Imagine B is a deck of cards. And the way I would shuffle them is to take them and do some move like this. And the most important property of this rather childish move of shuffling cards is they preserve the individual ordering of A and B. I can't mess up with the individual orderings in that process. So what this shuffle symbol does, it sums over all possibilities how this shuffle can happen. So let me give you two versions of the definition of the shuffle product. I already said in words what the unofficial definition will be. This shuffle product of ordered sets asks you to combine all possibilities to shuffle two decks of cards. So decks of cards is just a nickname for ordered sets, preserving their individual ordering. But if you show up on a meeting of mathematicians and want to discuss the shuffle product, they might get a bit irritated if all you do is waving your hands about how to shuffle cards. Maybe you also want to have an official definition. And that's a recursive one. Suppose we have very few cards. Suppose one of the sets is empty and, well, okay, the other set doesn't need to have few cards. What happens if you shuffle the empty set into something? In that case, this shuffle symbol is defined to just give you back A. So the empty deck is the neutral element in the shuffle algebra. And it's not only the left neutral, but also the right neutral element. Okay, so this is the induction start. And if we have two non-empty decks of cards, then the definition, the recursive definition of A shuffle B is, I spelled out what I meant by capital A. It's a sequence of little A's, and likewise capital B is a sequence of little B's. So I hope you're not surprised to see the little A's now on the right-hand side. The idea is peel off the first letter and shuffle the remaining letters into B. So then the right-hand side has a smaller shuffle as the left-hand side. And you can repeat that process until you are down to the above definition, where one of the two sets is empty. So you can easily convince yourself, if you do this sufficiently many times, you are back there. Okay, and all of this is pretty formal. Here I'm writing down a formal sum of ordered sets. So let me just make sure that there are no misunderstandings about that. I mean, here on the right-hand side, I was claiming that the product of zeta values gives you zeta of a shuffle. So such a shuffle will generically contain a sum of ordered sets. So let me define what I mean when this shuffle formula on the other blackboard outputs something like that. If you have a formal sum of ordered sets, then you do the most obvious thing you can dream of. Just do the sum of these zetas. And you will have a chance to go through an example in the tutorial today. And what you will furthermore do in the tutorial, after checking shuffle, let's now look at a second type of relation, which is called stuffle. So shuffle was nice when you remember that these are iterated integrals. We were rearranging integration domains to get shuffle. And I forgot to say, of course, you can do a higher dimensional version of this triangulation of the square. If there are longer iterated integrals, you just do triangulations of these higher dimensional objects that describe your integration domain. But stuffle does something else. To make stuffle fly, we need to remember the nested sum definition of multiple zeta values. So this is about rearrangements of summation ranges rather than integration ranges. So this is the direct analog of the triangulation exercise, what will come now. Okay, suppose you have a sum over k, and you multiply that with an independent sum over l. And you want to relate this to the kind of nested sums that appear over there. Then there are precisely three options how k and l can be related. It can be that k is smaller than l, which fits to the definition of multiple zetas. It can happen that k is bigger than l, but there's a third option which has no counterpart in case of iterated integrals. We can also have k equal l. These are the only three options. Okay, as I just emphasized, the first two have a similar flavor as what we did to the iterated integrals, to the triangulation exercise. So the first two, they just work like shuffle. And now this is the time to explain the name stuffle. We not only have shuffle-like terms, but we also have stuff. That's the reason why these relations are called stuff. Okay, and the simplest non-trivial example is if you have a product of single zeta values of course, it's a reasonable basis over Q to leave it like that, but let me just use it to illustrate what Stuffle does. So this is summing over k to the minus m. This is summing over l to the minus n. And let's just rearrange the product of infinite sums in here. And the first one will give you m comma n. The next one will give you n comma m. And finally, when the two summation variables are equal, you are getting m plus n. So let me encourage you to check that at home. Okay, I know it's lunchtime. Almost done. To wrap up, let me give you a flavor of what the independent zeta values at the lowest weights are. 5 more minutes, and I will hopefully get to a point to make sense of this statement here. Okay, let's now put everything together. Let's put duality and shuffle and stuffle together. If you have all of this in your toolkit, and if you furthermore have the routine you will get in the tutorial, then you can see that only the following MZVs appear to be linearly independent over Q. And I was already confessing that the transcendentality status of the odd zetas is unsettled. And likewise, whenever I claim that something is linearly independent over Q, it's a conjecture. It's based on all relations known up to date, but there's no guarantee that this is complete. Quite important conjecturally. And you might be surprised that I'm drawing a table now. I want to go through the multiple zeta values weight by weight. Why am I doing that? There is one funny property about all the relations we have seen before. All of these relations preserve the weight. So you can see this either from the definition as the sum of the arguments, or you can see it from the notion of weight as the number of integrations. You don't alter the length of the words if you shuffle cards. Normally, we don't lose cards when we shuffle them, unless you do it badly. Likewise, here with Stuffle, if we rearrange the summation domain, let's just look here at this example. We don't alter the sum of all the arguments. So all the relations we have seen before preserve the weight. If all we have are relations of this type, then the analysis of linearly dependent MZVs can be done weight by weight. It's very nice. We have this infinitely large space of MZVs, but whenever we check basis over Q, we do this in a finite subspace at a given weight. And at weight zero, it's maybe a formal thing whether or not you want to call this a multiple zeta value. So just regard this as a formal definition. At weight zero, we have a one-dimensional space spanned by Q. At weight one, there is no multiple zeta value. Whenever you try to write down an integral or a sum, for here, it diverges. Here we have an empty space of dimension 0. At weight 2, there's only one convergent sum or integral we can write down, that's zeta 2. At weight 3, for sure there's zeta 3. You might want to suggest the other one, which is also convergent, but we have seen the duality relation, that this is not there, or it's linearly dependent over Q by means of the duality. Okay, you can probably smell where this is going. We can repeat this again and again. At weight 4, we will work a bit in the tutorial on that to see that all you need is the square of zeta 2 to give you again a one-dimensional space. And weight 5 is a little highlight. That's the first time we are getting dimension 2 over the rationals. So at weight 5, there's not only zeta 5, but also a product, zeta 2 times zeta 3. So the promise is that any MZV at weight 5 can be written as a Q-linear combination of these two, or a dimension 2. Okay, things go analogously here for weight 6, and also for weight 7. Space. There is zeta 7. There is zeta 5 times zeta 2. There's also zeta 3 times zeta 2 squared. It might look to you as if all you need are the single zetas, but the first surprise comes at weight 8. People have worked hard, really hard, spell out all shuffle relations, all stuffle relations, all duality relations, hand it to your computer, ask Mathematica to solve. And it turns out the solution is giving you 4 linearly independent ones over Q. Not surprisingly, there's something like zeta 8. There is zeta 2, zeta 3 squared. There is zeta 3 times zeta 5. And now we are out of steam. As far as the single zetas are concerned, there's no further product of Riemann zetas one could write down. But we are not yet done. We haven't exhausted the space of solutions to shuffle stuff with duality. We need one more. And it's up to you which one you prefer, but you can't help having at least one higher depth zeta value. And many people favor this one, but there is no rigorous reason to dismiss another choice. So, remark number one, you could use a different double zeta instead. If you like, but okay, this is a rather empty issue. But more importantly, you can't eliminate. You can't express all weight 8 MZVs in terms of Riemann zetas. Okay, so this is the first time where you really need the higher depth zeta values. And then the question to the string is, does it appear, yes or no? At 4 points, the answer is no. You saw the closed formula. But at 5 points and higher, it does appear. So 4 points might give us a slightly inaccurate impression. The string amplitudes are sufficiently hungry, such as, at least for the open string, have all of them. OK, and the really very last information for this lecture is, if you look at the sequence of the dimensions below here, you might recognize this is a funny pattern. There is a conjecture by Zagier. What is the space, the dimension of that space for weight W? So Zagier observed that these dimensionalities over Q behave a bit like Fibonacci numbers. So from everything we know so far, it seems quite likely that the following recursion holds. It's almost like Fibonacci, but there's a bit more offset. Fibonacci would have W minus 1 and W minus 2. Is there a CH in Fibonacci? Maybe not. OK, sorry for going over time. And thanks a lot for your patience.